Okay, so we are today March 6th, 2024, and this is the MEES podcast. And guests today are Mr. James Cockayne, who is the managing editor of MEES, and Jamie Ingram, senior editor at MEES. And we're going to be talking about two developments in the Middle East on the energy front. And it's something that we've covered extensively. It's Qatar deciding to go even further with its LNG expansion, and Saudi Arabia rolling back its oil production capacity plans. If we look back, these announcements came shortly after the end of COP28, the climate summit in Dubai, which was supposed to signal the beginning of the end of fossil fuels. So how do we explain these two very different policies by two giants in the Middle East, you know, the beholder of the biggest gas reserves in the Middle East, Qatar, one of the top exporters of LNG, and Saudi Arabia, obviously, a holder of the biggest conventional oil reserves in the world and a major exporter, OPEC kingpin. So in light of this evolving energy landscape, how do we explain it? Shell says in its LNG outlook that demand is going to rise by more than 50% by 2040. US administration has ordered a pause of new LNG projects and contracts to non-FTA countries. So how is this going to impact future supply growth? And there are obviously other LNG projects that are due to come online. So Jamie, I'm going to start with you on James, I'm going to start with you on the LNG. Are they on the right track with this new additional expansion?
I think what we've seen over the last couple of years is just how price-sensitive LNG demand is, especially in the key Asian growth markets. So not just, well, obviously, Japan vies with China as one of the biggest importers, as the biggest importer at the moment. Japan's in decline. Korea's probably in decline as well. China demand's continuing to grow, but the big, big growth markets are India, which is already the world's number four, I think, LNG importer. And as we've seen, it's a very price-sensitive importer. Bangladesh, Pakistan are current importers and could import a lot more. The Philippines has just begun to import LNG quite recently. Vietnam as well. And throughout East and Southeast Asia and South Asia, there's the potential for LNG demand to grow much more, depending on price. You know, when after Russia invaded Ukraine and there was a big, obviously, gas crunch in Europe in 2022, prices went through the roof, and we saw Indian imports fall through the floor. Pakistan's imports fell nearly to zero. So what I would say with Qatar further boosting their expansion, this is, all other things being equal, this is going to mean, alongside the US export expansion, notwithstanding the pause, it's going to mean prices are going to remain moderate for decades to come. And that should, I would expect, and certainly I'm sure the Qataris hope, this is going to guarantee strong demand for LNG for decades to come as well. So I think it's a smart move and it'll work out well. I guess, you know, remains to be seen what will happen in practice, certainly in the Asian market. So at the moment, Qatar, some of their exports go to Europe, obviously. But with US exports ramping up as well, the structural surplus in the Atlantic Basin market is going to become more so. So one would expect the vast bulk of additional Qatari volumes to stay in Asia. And obviously, we've talked about the energy transition, at least in Asia, and especially new Asian markets such as India, Bangladesh, Vietnam, the Philippines, the rival fuel to gas and LNG is coal in the most part. So I think this demand is fairly transition proof, if you like, at least for the next few decades, much more so than you would say about Europe. I mean, in addition as well, Qatar has been pretty smart about emphasizing, I think they use the word green. I mean, whether you'd call their LNG green, it might be a bit of a push, but certainly they've paid a lot of attention to the emissions associated with their output. A lot of talk about CCS, a lot of talk about monitoring emissions. This gives them a big advantage over the US as the other key exporter as well. I mean, obviously in Qatar, everything is state-dominated, state-controlled. It's one set of facilities, very large facilities, but one set of facilities, one operator. The US is much more fragmented, obviously it's private sector firms, and more importantly, the companies that are exporting the LNG in the US are not the same companies who control the upstream. So even if they want to export zero carbon or green LNG, it's much more difficult in the US to put the system in place whereby these things are monitored. I don't think as well, if let's say Trump gets back in and he throws the green agenda out of the window, I don't think that particularly helps US exporters either. I mean, I don't know whether any of them will speak out against Trump's ripping up of green policies and the IRA and that sort of thing, but we'll see.
Yeah, I don't think Trump can tear up everything, because some of the new jobs that have been created are in sort of Republican states, and also there are tax incentives that I don't think he's going to take away. But talking about US, I mean, prices are at rock bottom, but of course Qatar is sort of insulated because they have very low cost anyway. I mean, gas prices are at a decades low at the moment in the US. We're seeing shutdowns, but I'm just wondering if that's going to have an impact on other new projects that are far more costly, a lot of them have been delayed. But let's sort of stop with, I haven't seen anything. I mean, has Qatar actually said that they're going to include carbon capture? Because they are part of the global methane pledge. There's going to be a lot more pressure by consuming countries and, border adjustment mechanism in Europe. So you can't really expect to continue to export without doing anything about methane, capturing methane and capturing CO2.
Do you want to answer that?
Sure. No, they haven't explicitly stated that yet, but it's still very early stages, and they've made very clear in recent years that all projects going forward will have CCS as a key part of it from the design stage onwards. So I think we can guarantee that they will have CCS. Qatar's also investing a lot in solar to try and decarbonize the production of LNG and other processes as well. So we're already seeing solar plants at Ras Laffan move towards completion. Probably we're likely to see those expanded as well in the coming years to provide more electricity for the LNG operations.
And I mean, from what we've reported, is that Qatar is sort of insisting on long-term contracts, and a lot of them linked to crude oil, which at the moment, with gas prices so low, does that make sense? I mean, are they going to come under pressure in marketing this new gas to sort of move away from the oil link?
I would be surprised if we do see them move away from the oil link. At the moment, the spot market is very immature, subject to significant volatility, which, as we saw with some of those more price-sensitive importers that James mentioned earlier, they really struggle with that. They need the reliability that comes from the oil-linked ones. And certainly, Qatar's Minister of Energy, the head of Qatar Energy, Saad Al-Kaabi, he is very wedded to the idea of these long-term contracts. So I think we'll continue with that for sure going forward.
And of course, Qatar's not alone, because we're seeing expansion in the UAE. Oman is considering adding a fourth train. And even Saudi Arabia. You've just come back from Saudi Arabia, Jamie, and you mentioned that Saudi Arabia, which has this sort of, which has just updated its gas reserve estimates, and they've got Jafurah, they're going to have a lot of liquids, they were thinking of blue ammonia, but without an off-taker, which they don't yet have, they're even considering LNG. Is that something that's possible?
Definitely. I think that for the moment, the key priority for Saudi Arabia when it comes to the LNG sector is looking internationally. We're expecting any day now this entity called MidOcean LNG, which was formed and backed by private equity group EIG, to finalize the completion of purchase of four assets in Australia. Saudi Aramco is going to invest in MidOcean basically as soon as this Australian takeover is complete. That's going to be the trigger for it. So Aramco will move into the LNG game very soon. CEO Amin Nasser he's, you know, he's spoken of Saudi Aramco's ambition to be a leading player within the LNG sphere. In more recent days as well, Reuters reported just overnight, I think it was, that Aramco has been shortlisted to purchase Singapore's Pavilion LNG. So that's another asset that that Aramco is looking to move into. Yes, they are looking domestically as well. You mentioned the blue ammonia thing. Blue ammonia is obviously seen as being a key fuel for the energy transition, clean burning fuel, but it's very difficult to create these markets. Saudi Aramco is basically saying that until firm offtake agreements have been signed, i.e. someone is willing to front the money to guarantee purchases moving forward, they won't finalize any investment decisions on the blue ammonia. That could leave them with a lot of gas on their hands. So they are considering looking into the domestic LNG now. When I was in Saudi Arabia last month, Aramco's upstream president, Nasser Al-Naimi, did reference very clearly that they are examining the potential for moving into the domestic LNG area, but probably not just yet. I think for now, it's very much an overseas game for Saudi Arabia.
Because, I mean, there has been a lot of focus by Saudi Arabia on their gas. They've expanded their gas production, and now, of course, Jafurah unconventional. And they're calling themselves more an energy company, right? I think you reported this. So the fact that they're not going to invest in new additional oil production capacity, are the two related?
Yes and no. They were already investing heavily in their gas sector. Are they going to invest more in the gas sector after this decision not to expand their crude oil production capacity? Probably not. I think that they've already laid the groundwork for significant investment in gas as it was. You know, the plan is to go up to about 18.5 billion CFD by the end of this decade. Essentially, you know, a massive increase for Saudi Arabia. Primarily, that is aimed at the domestic market. Basically, they burn a lot of oil in power plants because they don't have enough gas. So that's the key driver of moving into the gas, boosting their domestic output. This is, you know, it has a number of benefits as well, outside of simply being a cleaner burning fuel for power generation. It also frees up significant amounts of oil that can be exported onto global markets. They burn about 1 million barrels a day of crude oil and fuel oil domestically at the moment. That's a lot of money that's going up in smoke. So there's a clear economic rationale to be doing that, to be ending this process. The gas production, you mentioned the Jafurah Basin project earlier. That's the Middle East's largest unconventional gas deposit. They're looking to produce 2 billion CFD of gas from that. But crucially, they're also going to be producing more than 600,000 barrels a day of liquids from this project. So again, that's another significant tranche of oil that they can then sell onto international markets. So currently, because of OPEC production cuts, they're sitting on about 3 million barrels a day of spare capacity. Add another million from displaced oil, another 600,000 from the additional oil production from Jafurah. They simply, you know, investing in increasing their crude oil production capacity just simply isn't the smartest way to yield returns for the government.
Because when you're in Saudi Arabia, I think you reported that some of the, when the government had asked them, I think it was still over a year ago, asked them to go from 12 million barrels a day to 13 million barrels a day. That's Aramco capacity, of course. There's additional capacity from the neutral zone, which I think is about 200 so that takes them up to 12. And that they had already taken final investment decisions on certain expansions from certain fields. So maybe you could sort of go through it, because basically they can then raise production capacity from certain fields and then relax them in other fields, including Ghawar, which used to be a 5 million barrel a day field.
That's absolutely right. So they had already taken final investment decision on primarily offshore fields that were going to yield this extra million barrels a day capacity. That's Marjan, Zuluf, and Berri. They are still going ahead with increasing capacity from these fields. But instead of maintaining capacity at some of the more mature fields, they're going to allow that just to slip back. So now this additional million barrels a day from offshore is going to offset declines elsewhere. You mentioned Bawa. Yes, that was 5 million. Now it's 3.8 million barrels a day. Officials that I spoke to in Saudi Arabia said that Ghawa is definitely going to be one of the fields that they allow capacity to decline at. It won't all come from there, of course. They're not going to take 1 million barrels a day off of Ghawa, but yeah, it's as the kingdom's largest field, it's going to see a pretty hefty share of the decline. It's also worth noting as well that when Saudi Aramco initially took the decision to expand at Marjan Duluth Berri, that was initially conceived precisely for this purpose, that it would be offsetting declines and the production capacity would remain at 12 million barrels a day. That was subsequently wrapped up into this expansion project, which they've now reversed their decision. It's going to be the initial plan sustained through these projects.
Because there was a time when, you know, Saudi Arabia was the biggest oil producer, it was biggest oil exporter, and of course that's been taken over by the US. The US is now the biggest oil producer. But if you look at OPEC policy, which, you know, I mean, Saudi Arabia has the biggest voice in OPEC and even OPEC Plus, they've now decided to extend their production cut, which they put at 2.2 million, but we've calculated it actually is a bit less because the 1 million voluntary cut from Saudi Arabia was sort of carried over. So I don't know, James, you want to take that one? So they're actually, are they making way for this additional crude coming from Brazil, from Guyana, from the US?
I mean, obviously the perpetual risk for OPEC and for OPEC Plus is that they're always going to grow their market share in the future, right? You know, it's like if you look back a decade ago, 2 decades ago, always the global market share of OPEC was predicted to rise in 5 years' time. And I guess it's still predicted to rise in 5 years' time. You know, the risk is if you pursue a policy of supporting prices, or whether or not that's stated, it's certainly a key aim, right? If you pursue a policy of supporting prices, it supports prices for everyone and it spurs more production elsewhere. I mean, so, you know, US output is at record levels, 13 million barrels a day of crude, 20 million including NGLs. I mean, this NGL story isn't just one for Saudi. It's certainly a story for the US as well, you know, record NGLs output. Qatar as well, actually, the expansion of Qatar is going to produce a lot of NGLs. So it's important, you know, often global dialogue about oil supply is very focused on crude because of the OPEC policy of focusing on crude, right? But I think you have to look at liquids overall. So the, you know, one reason that the oil companies in the US have had the confidence to invest is they've seen that OPEC wants to keep prices well supported. That's given confidence to invest up Brazil as well. I mean, Brazil output's at record levels. Guyana, I guess, is the other big expansion. You know, Exxon and now Chevron's trying to get a piece of the action there as well. And I think just today we saw a press release from Total with Qatar Energy, I think, making a discovery off Namibia again. So, you know, Namibia could be a big oil province as well. So I think the risk for, I mean, obviously I can understand it from the perspective of Saudi Arabia and other OPEC and OPEC plus countries wanting to have a stable revenue stream. You know, they don't want oil prices to go from $100 a barrel to 30 to 100 again. They want it to be stable so they can invest. But the risk is that this will basically mean giving up market share in perpetuity, I suppose, forever, you know, at least until potentially the energy transition cuts into demand.
Yeah, I was just going to say that it's arguably the case that OPEC Plus is waiting for the kind of the US shale revolution to burn out. And I think some forecasts certainly suggest that it's slowing, you know, production gains in the US are slowing down considerably from this year onwards. I think even the EIA is suggesting that oil demand, its current peak from Q4 last year, won't be matched again this year. So while on an annual basis, US oil output is going to increase in 2024, we won't see new actual monthly quarterly records until 2025. So yeah, OPEC is hoping that you don't need to necessarily go into a market share, into a price war, just to eventually get that market share back. But it's a risky game, especially when you do see new basins like Guyana starting to really muscle into the picture.
And that's what I was going to say. You know, you look at the IEA, and the IEA thinks that their scenarios show that all fossil fuels are going to peak by the end of the decade. Of course, OPEC doesn't agree, and they see continued demand up until 2045. Shell says, you know, a 50% increase by 2040 in LNG. So, and of course, there's been this, what some people are calling a sort of politicization of data, because OPEC and IEA have never really been that far apart in their they're not really forecast. I mean, in the case of the IEA, they'll say it's not forecast, it's modeling. It's, you know, this is what will happen if these policies actually are implemented. So is that something that is going to be an issue? Are we going to see a glut in supplies of both LNG and possibly crude oil if those demand projections actually turn out to be at least partly close to the...
Well, I think the one thing that James alluded to earlier is the price-sensitive nature of a lot of the buyers of LNG. I think that Qatar is basically banking on a strategy: if you make your own demand, they're going to be, you know, currently their capacity is, what, 77 million tonnes a year? Under the old plan, up until earlier this year, they were going to go to 126 million tonnes a year by 2027, 2028. Now they're saying 142 by 2030. Essentially, they're going to ensure that the world remains very, very well supplied with LNG for the foreseeable future. That should encourage some of these less affluent countries to say, yes, we are willing to make that switch from coal to LNG. That locks in demand. So, you know, that could arguably result in higher demand forecasts in years to come. I don't know, but, you know, I think that with LNG, unlike crude oil, you do create your own demand to some extent. Very different position with crude oil, where it is more of a mature market, and a lot of the demand sources at the moment can be replaced by alternatives, such as, you know, obviously transportation. You're looking at EVs that have really rocketed in affluent countries. And if you look at what the IEA is saying, there's no reason why you can't have take up in outside of the developed world as well.
Yes, well, I mean, it's a good thing. And the gas producers will sort of argue that it's actually not a bad thing if you replace coal and you've got so many new projects that are sort of supposed to come online, in mainly in Asia, China, India. Well, I think it's 500 megawatts of coal-fired, which some people think will not actually happen because China is committed to ending its... be carbon neutral, and I think to end CO2 emissions by...
2060, I think it's the...
2060 is carbon neutrality, okay. But emissions peak, they're expecting, by the end of the decade, which sounds a bit optimistic, okay. But it's, and it's funny that we're seeing a sort of reversal of what happened at the start of the Ukraine crisis, where gas prices went through the roof and you were getting oil replacing gas for power generation in Europe because it was cheaper than gas. But prices generally of both, I mean, gas is actually very low at the moment, but even oil, it's been range bound despite all the geopolitical risk, you know, Red Sea attacks. I think we saw one yesterday. Another one yesterday. We've been reporting a lot on what's happening in the Red Sea with Houthi attacks on shipping that don't seem to be ending. So despite this geopolitical risk, the fact that there is still this sort of fear, concern that it might escalate, that it might draw in, you know, other Iranian proxies, external forces and so on. But prices have been relatively stable. They're range bound, you know, they haven't really...
Yeah, the market's largely been trading sideways recently. Prices haven't been going up. As you say, an awful lot of tensions there. But so far, supply hasn't been hit. People do point to the massive amount of spare capacity that we have at the moment as a reason for that. I think that's a little bit overblown. After all, if you're talking about a Middle East conflict, that's where that spare capacity sits. So that can all be wiped out very quickly in a worst case scenario. But that's a scenario that is extremely unlikely. We've seen a lot of conflict scares in recent years, even localized conflicts, and it hasn't extended to the big producers. People obviously can point to 2019 when there was a serious attack against Saudi facilities with Abqaiq, but the kingdom was able to bring production online from elsewhere in very short order and ride over that.
But I think it's products that are suffering more. I think there's a bit of tightness in the products market. It's been affected more than crude oil.
I mean, certainly with what's happened with Russia and European sanctions on Russia. That's complicated. You know, the big picture trend in global refining of the last decade, or one of the key trends, has been European refiners retrenching, right, closing plants. So one of the reasons they could do that, or did do that, was because there was a lot of cheap products available from Russia. So suddenly they've, you know, stopped buying for the most part from Russia. That's created a certain amount of tightness in Europe, and they were making up for that to an extent by buying products, distillates in particular, from the Gulf and from India. So obviously what's happened in the Suez Canal and Red Sea has complicated that. I mean, so far the markets have worked pretty well, you know, even in this instance. You know, I certainly haven't read any stories about, you know, diesel running out in Germany or something like this, you know. But
yeah, the issue with everyone, when people look at Europe, they're just concerned about the economic picture, frankly, so that, you know, demand is going down at the same time as you have these supply concerns. Well, not, sorry, demand growth is going down at the same time as you have these supply concerns.
And also, yeah, because you've had to shut down, I mean, Germany's had to shut down some plants because of, you know, to sort of preserve their, to keep demand low. I think we've reached the end of the podcast, so I just want to thank you, James and Jamie, for...
Thank you, Kate, as well. You didn't introduce yourself at the beginning. So, thank
I'm
you,
Kate Durian. I'm Kate Durian, and I'm hosting this podcast from London today.
Bye.
Thank you for listening.
Thank you very much.
Bye.